morning, and welcome to Fiberhooligan. I'm your host, Benjamin Levesay, and for the next hour or so, I'd like to invite you to grab your cup of coffee, tea, or Diet Dr. Pepper, if that's beverage of choice, and settle in for the 49th episode of Fiberhooligan. For those of you who are wondering who the heck I am the CEO of XRX Inc., home of Knitters Magazine, XRX Books, and Stitches Expos. And I'm broadcasting live this morning from my home here in Harrisburg, South Dakota. Okay, my guest today is one of the most savvy business people in the fiber arts world. She's also someone who's courageous and generous of spirit, and I'm very happy to be able to have her on the podcast today. Originally from North Carolina, she earned a master's in poli-sci, but switched gears while earning her PhD to computer programming, a favorite subject of hers. After lots of hard work, she landed a software developing job in Palo Alto, which is where she met her future husband, Doug. Wanting a change in the hectic pace of Silicon Valley, they moved to scenic Tahoe, where she started to design... Oh, sorry, folks, we're having just a bit of echo on the thing. I'm going to just back that up. After a lot of hard work, she landed a software developing job in Palo Alto, which is where she met her future husband, Doug. Wanting a change from the hectic pace of Silicon Valley, they moved to scenic Tahoe, where she started to design websites for small companies. During this time, she learned to knit and loved it, which is how she met Lorna, owner of a local hand-dyed yarn company. Lorna encouraged her to follow her true passion, knitting, and voila. She and her husband emptied their savings account, and Jimmy Bean's Wools was born. She joins us today to talk about the evolution of Jimmy Bean's Wools, Stitch Red, her philosophies on business, the fiber arts industry, successes, challenges, and what's in store for the future, and much more. I'm speaking to my friend, Laura Zander. Laura joins us this morning from Reno, Nevada. Good morning, Laura, and welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. It's truly a pleasure. You and I don't hang out enough, and that's something that I'd kind of like to fix in the future, because you're a very interesting person, and if nothing else, I just need you to coach me on how to be more successful in business and everything you do.
Yeah, I learned it all from watching you.
See, folks, she knows how to lie, too. That's great. I really appreciate that.
No.
So how is the weather out there in Nevada this morning?
Oh, it's good. It's warming up. We got about 2 feet of snow this past weekend. Thank goodness I was in Atlanta where it was nice. But now it's supposed to warm up to the mid-70s or so. But it's, 30 degrees in the morning, 70 degrees during the day. Big swings.
Yes.
It's beautiful. No clouds.
Yeah, just an awful place to live, I understand.
Yeah, that's what we tell people, and that's, we're trying to keep people away, so
keep the riffraff,
highlight like all the bad things. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a good idea. Here in South Dakota, we lie to them and tell them it's great here, that the winters are mild, and we try to get everybody to move here. No one's buying it, though, Laura. No one's buying it.
Right. Yeah. Well,
okay, well, let's get right to the show.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Please go ahead. No, please go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, this is if you like to ski or like to mountain bike or like to even just be outside. It's the Mecca. That's how we think of it.
See, that sounds very athletic. And you should know, that I'm not very much an outdoorsy kind of guy. I'm not a roughing it kind of guy. My idea of roughing it is going to a hotel that doesn't have room service.
Yeah. Doug and I met. We grew up kind of mountain climbing, and actually Huck and I were laughing last night. We thought about, just for the heck of it, like sleeping in the yard, because we're like, it's just fun, why sleep on a bed when you can sleep on grass? So I guess that's slightly different.
I'm gonna have to take your word on that, because again, the outdoors is something I appreciate, and I like to pull up my computer and look at pictures of the outdoors. I think that's the best way to enjoy it.
Great. Well, now I know what to do. I'll just start sending you all the pictures so you can live through me and I can live through you.
Okay, that will do that. All right, let's get right into the show today, because you have a fascinating story. You have a lot to say, and I want to make sure we get it all in. And I know the Fiberhooligan listeners are going to love you. Let's give the Fiberhooligan listeners a little background about you. Let's talk about where you're from, and let's talk about your folks and how you grew up a little bit.
Sure. I was born in D.C., or Fairfax County, Virginia. So lived in Georgia, lived in Delaware. We moved around a lot. My parents split up when I was 3. My mom and I ended up living in Garner, in a trailer park. And ended up kind of moving up the chain, I guess, of socioeconomic status. When I was five, we moved to an apartment complex. It was amazing. A lot of single-parent families there. So we were, Benjamin and I were talking, you and I were talking the other day about, you know, communities are like that are just a training ground for entrepreneurism, if you will. And, of course, I didn't realize it at the time. I only realized it maybe 2 or 3 years ago, but I guess I was kind of a business person to begin with because I used to go, you know, my mom was always gone. I'd come home at, you know, 9 or 10 o'clock. You know, it's kind of standard single parent family for when I grew up in our community. So we were all running around like crazy kids. But I would go from door to door in the apartment complex, and it was a huge complex. I mean, it must have been hundreds, thousands and thousands of people, you know, thousands of apartments there. So go around and knock door to door and say, hi, I'm five, I'm Laura, what can I do for money? And they would just look at me, and I'd be like, no, I'm serious. Like, for a quarter, I'll wash your windows, I'll do your dishes. If you want, I can stay and keep you company. There were a lot of retired people there. I can stay and keep you company while you watch TV. I'll do anything. And my husband likes to laugh, but eventually, you know, I'd made so much money doing that, and I got kind of bored with it that I would just go around and I'd say, I'd just knock on people's door and say, hi, can I have some money? And see how many people would say yes to that, and they did. It was amazing. So I learned a great lesson that if you just ask, 9 times out of 10, people will say yes.
Well, so a business mind right away, and, you know, I get the sense that, you know, you were on your own devices when you were younger. I mean, again, you talk about, you know, mom working and you running around like crazy. I mean, I had something similar when I was younger. You know, I was alone a lot. You know, my mom was working during the day. And it's an interesting environment when that happens.
It is. And now that I have a son and I can, you know, I look at him, he's almost five, and I think about the way he is, the environment that he's in compared to the environment I was in, and it's just, it's unbelievable how different it is, neither good nor bad. I mean, I learned a lot of really great things. But, yeah, I mean, I was, you know, I don't want to say I was on my own, but I was on my own in a lot of ways and got to learn a lot by experimentation and by, you know, testing things myself instead of someone being there necessarily to guide me. And then had a bunch of friends, you know, the environment that we lived in, we were all in kind of similar situations. So then we could all, like, test things out together. So, you know, again, I've met a lot of people that I've met that have a similar business drive, I guess, kind of grew up in very similar environments where, what do they say, necessity is the founder of innovation or something like that. You learn to be creative.
And you definitely are creative. I'd like to talk about you going to school because you've been very candid about talking about going to school. You went to several different places, and you told me privately you went where the money was. And a lot of that had to do with your dad's philosophy about your schooling as well. Can you tell us where you went to school and, you know, about that philosophy of your father's?
Oh, sure. You know, I grew up, my mother was a you know, and you and I talked about this, and you can see it in the video. My mother was mentally ill. She was a genius, beautiful, homecoming queen, but had a hard time with life. And so, therefore, I was on my own a lot, you know, lived by myself in high school. And my father, because of my mother's upbringing, or because of the way she was, and I lived with her full time, you know, he was a little nervous about me and how I was going to end up and was worried. He wanted to make sure that my independent nature was strengthened. So when it was time to go to college, I was a straight-A student in high school. You know, I had a 4.2 GPA. I played 4 sports a year. I worked 20 hours a week. So I always had the, I guess, the just the kind of work ethic, I suppose, that as long as I got good grades, as long as I did well in sports, and as long as I worked a lot, that would carry me through. And so when it came to college, my dad said, you know, I'm not going to help you with college. If you want to go to college, then you need to pay for it yourself. And my dad's, you know, well-educated. At this point, he lives in Texas, well-educated software engineer. And he just said, figure it out. You know, you're going to need to figure it out. And at this point, you know, from all the quarters that I had collected from elementary school, I also sold Nerds. I used to buy boxes of Nerds and then dump them in a Ziploc bag, and I would sell them by the tablespoonful. So that was like precursor drug dealership. so I made a ton of great margin on that. And one of our friends actually, and this is really bad, but one of our friends used to steal them from the grocery store. So that was his gig. So he'd steal them. We'd buy them for him for cheaper than we would get them from the grocery store. Then I would dump them and I'd, you know, parse them out. And I had this, you know, my little tablespoon, teaspoon rig. Anyway, made tons of money. So had saved up a bunch and ended up going to NC State because that was the only place I applied and the only place I could afford to go. You know, my meal plan was $800. I had like $3,000 in the bank. And then I worked full-time in college as well. I was a security guard at night and then a waitress in the afternoon, you know, from 5 to 9. And then I was a security guard from 10 p.m. till 4 a.m. And ended up, you know, there for a year. Then I did a co-op, and I made $8.03 an hour at Northern Telecom. I'll never forget. And was able to save up enough, and I moved to Texas. Things with my mom had gotten pretty bad. We actually didn't even know where she was anymore, so I left and I moved to Texas to be near my dad, and I finished college there. But I did the same thing. I finished in 2.5 years because I was paying for it myself. So I worked my butt off, and I figured out how to take, at the time they were correspondence courses instead of online classes. So I would end up taking 20 to 25 hours, you know, a semester through correspondence classes. I would test out of stuff. But when I say I would test out, I found out like there were these CLEP tests and I could test out of Algebra 1. You know, I wasn't testing out of like Russian 6. So I got very creative again on how to get out of school quickly. And luckily I got out of school quickly with a 3.9. And so grad school said that they would pay for me. So I went to Washington State, got a degree in political science, a master's. And then Pennsylvania State, Penn State, so they'd pay me to come work on a PhD, so I did that for a year. And still didn't know what I wanted to do. I was 21 or 22 years old, and my dad offered me a job in San Francisco working as a software documenter. So I would, you know, read code, a technical documentation person. So I would read code and translate it into English. And then that's where I met Doug and my whole life, and
yes.
And I learned how to knit.
It's, yes. So, yeah, you moved to San Francisco. Your dad got you the job, and you met your future husband. And you and your husband were both in that whole dot-com startup world of computer code that was so exciting back then.
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, I am so lucky. I am one of the luckiest people in the world to have experienced that. That was 97, 98, 99. You know, as I was telling you the other day, I didn't have much software experience at all. But because the demand was so high, I never had a problem getting a job and getting a good paid, you know, well-paid job. And I would take classes at night as well to try to make up for the fact of, you know, make up for my lack of a formal education. But just, oh, my God, the fervor and, you know, the camaraderie and the teamwork and the way that everybody just – comes together and you work until midnight, like 6 days a week, and you do it because you want to. You know, you do it because it's fun and you're all in it together. And yeah, and you do it because every day you come to work, you look at somebody else's stock options and realize, oh my gosh, if we went public today, I would be worth $8 billion. And, you know, of course, I did finally get one check from one of the companies I worked for about 3 years ago, and it was for $2.43. So that's what my options ended up being worth. But we had great dreams, and we were all in it together.
Well, so eventually you left the Bay Area, and it's a good story about why you left the Bay Area. Can you tell our listeners why you left the Bay Area? Why leave? And you know, and what was the move?
Sure, Doug is from Wisconsin. He's from Madison. Went to Wisconsin. He's a finance major. So neither one of us was from San Francisco, had both lived in the Denver area. My dad had lived in Evergreen for a while, so I would go visit him there. So we actually had these dreams of, okay, when the bubble burst, we were like, why don't we just move to Denver? You know, we don't have any ties here. We don't need to stay here. My dad had since moved back to Texas. And we were thinking about it, and we were ready because we thought his company was going to go under. We thought my company was going to go under any day. And we thought it'd be a great opportunity. And we were thinking about it, and we were like, you know what? We had just bought a house. We were married at this point, and we had just bought a small cabin up in the Lake Tahoe area. And we're like, oh, well, I guess we could move there. I mean, we own the house. You know, it never occurred to us. Because it's a town of 14,000 people. I mean, there's, you know, nothing. So we decided. I went in one day to work and said, I quit my job. We're moving to Tahoe. Doug went in and said he quit his job. My boss said, you know what? Don't quit. Why? You can just work from Tahoe. So he gave me 5 computers. I was doing server testing at the time. Gave me 5 computers, sent me on my way, and I didn't get laid off for another 6 months. And Doug ended up getting a job in Sacramento, which was about an hour and a half away, so he commuted there. And, yeah, we just decided to make a lifestyle change. We thought, you know what, let's just go mountain bike and ski and run and just live, and we'll figure the rest out. And that's what we did, and so far it's worked out pretty well.
So your original intention was to leave the hustle and bustle of Silicon Valley so that you could have, you know, a slower-paced lifestyle and not work quite as many hours. That was the original idea? How'd that
yeah,
work? How did that work out for you?
Not so great. Not so great. Yeah.
It's okay. You and I talked about that. I mean, you know, once you realize that you are a workaholic, you just need to accept it and move forward. But so you moved to Nevada and you worked from home for a while and you were building websites.
Yes. Yep. And just technically, we were in California. Now, our house in Reno, for most people don't realize that Reno is like 5 miles from California. They're just sister towns. So when we actually had 2 shops, we had one in Reno, one in Truckee, they were less than 30 minutes apart from each other. So anyway, but that's a technicality. So yeah, we were there, and I thought, well, I'll just start building websites once I finally got laid off. And before we left San Francisco, I had learned how to knit. I went into a knitting store just randomly. I'd learned how to crochet when I was in college. I actually did an internship with the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearm. And as I was telling you, we would have these late night raids, and you know, I remember one time, you know, we were raiding a Chinese organized crime ring in downtown Houston. And so we had a lot of downtime, and one of the women there taught me how to crochet. And I was addicted. I mean, just addicted. I must have made 100 or 150 blankets and just loved it. So when I moved to San Francisco, I found a knitting shop and walked in. And I'd never been to one because I'd only crocheted with Red Heart, literally, you know, from Walmart. And I didn't even know the other world existed. Went into a knitting shop, saw what a local yarn shop looks like, and I signed up for a class, like, immediately. And it changed my life in so many ways. But I became immediately addicted. And so when we moved to Tahoe, I had opened up an issue of Vogue Knitting magazine and saw an ad for Lorna's Laces in the back of the magazine and saw that the address was Somerset, California. And that was only about an hour and a half from my house. So I called Lorna and said, hey, can I build you a website? And she eventually said yes. So I built a website for her and got to know her, and she kind of introduced me to the world of the local yarn shop and how you could actually have a business as a local yarn shop owner, you know, and it would not just be a hobby. So I also, go ahead.
I just wanted to say we have to send out a shout out of thanks to Lorna Meiser for, you know, being there for you and helping you get introduced. This is back when Lorna Meiser was the owner of Lorna's Laces, correct?
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Operating out of her basement.
Yeah. Anyway, please go
on. So I was just going to say, and so then I also did the website for an espresso card manufacturer in Grass Valley. They were really the only 2 clients I ever had, actually, and 1 realty company, but that's it. So I did not build a very successful software company. and the espresso cart manufacturer, once Lorna convinced me and I convinced Doug that we should open a yarn shop in Truckee because there wasn't another one around for miles and miles and miles, we decided, you know what, we should hedge our bets. And we're not just going to have yarn, especially since I don't really know how to knit very well anyway. but let's have a coffee shop as well because downtown Truckee could really use a spot. At the time, they needed a spot with some couches and some tables that people could have coffee in the morning. So this espresso cart manufacturer traded me my work for a really great deal on an espresso cart. And we opened it up. Jimmy was my nickname that Doug had given me. Beans was for the coffee beans because now we were a little coffee shop. And then wool was obviously for the yarn. It was a little 500-square-foot shop. And the main source of income for probably the first 6 months is that I delivered coffee to all the downtown shops. So people would, you know, I'd deliver these little flyers around that said, you know, if you need coffee, let me know, I'll deliver. So I'd literally have a customer in the store that was looking at yarn, and then somebody would call and say, I need a latte. And I'd have to tell the customer, can you just hold on for 5 minutes? And if anybody comes in, will you let them know I'll be right back? And, you know, thanks for holding down the fort for me, and give them the keys. And then I'd run out and deliver the coffee and come back. And the side effect is you end up with some pretty good friends because you just trusted your entire life to them.
So I get the beans, of course, and I get the wool. There's, you know, coffee shop, there should be beans in it. Wool, that, you know, that's a local yarn store. You said that Jimmy's your nickname. You got to tell us a story about Jimmy.
Oh, yeah. So when Doug and I first met, actually we were up at Mount Shasta where we ended up getting married. We were listening to an album from a guy, a CD, a guy named Todd Snyder, and he was a singer-songwriter. And Doug knew, I mean, I grew up in the South, grew up in, you know, the rural South at some points of my life, and had lived in a couple of different trailer parks. I was always really proud of that. You know, it's a great community. And there's this song called Double Wide Blues. And as we're listening to it, there's a guy in the trailer park whose name is Jimmy. And he is the coolest guy in the whole trailer park, but mostly because he has a blue plastic pool on his back deck. So he's the only guy in the park that's got a pool. So everybody's over at his house all the time. So Doug started, you know, again, he's from the Midwest. He's sarcastic. He's like, oh, my God, you're cool like Jimmy. And so he just started calling me Jimmy, and he's never called me anything else. And so then as I, you know, we'd only been dating for a few months, so as I was introduced to his family, introduced to his friends, introduced to everybody, they all called me Jimmy. Nobody's ever called me anything else, you know, in our personal life on that side. So, yeah, so that's where the Jimmy came from. And, you know, Lorna Miser had introduced me to Diane Susie from Knitting Pure and Simple. She lived in Truckee. And Diane ended up being, you know, just my mentor. I mean, none of this would have happened if it weren't for her. And I remember looking at the building with the real estate agent and standing in the parking lot thinking, what are we going to call this place? And I was like, Diane, and she was, you know, 30 years older than I am. I'm like, Diane, what do you think about Truckee Knits or, you know, Truckee River Yarn? Or Doug and I were kind of thinking, what about Jimmy Bean's Wool? And I just thought Diane was just going to roll her eyes and say, that's ridiculous. Yeah, Truckee River Knits, it's perfect. And she was like, I like it. And we were like, oh, my God, if Diane likes it, done. Like, we never thought about it again. That was it. That was the end of the discussion. Because to me, you know, Diane was God. You know, whatever she says was what we were going to do. And it was one of the best decisions we've ever made in our business life.
Well, I'm glad you did, and it's a great name. So, you know, you had never done anything like this before. You hadn't been in business except for, you know, selling nerds that were fell off the back of a truck, and you had really not much experience doing the retail thing or waiting on customers, except for when you were doing the waitress thing. You know, so what was your plan? I mean, what was your expectations? I mean, you emptied out your savings account. You know,
yeah.
And what was the plan? What was your expectations?
I didn't really have a plan. I mean, we didn't do a business plan or I don't know. I think, you know, Doug, and he'll deny it, but he won't, he'll deny it with a smirk. I think he probably thought, well, $30,000 for her to do that is probably cheaper than her, you know, than the mental institution bills that are going to pile up, you know, if she doesn't end up having a job, or if I end up at Starbucks. So, I don't know. I really thought, if I could just make, you know, if I could do $30,000 a year, the equivalent of, you know, a full-time job, let's say at Starbucks, and that meant that I could mountain bike in the morning or run in the afternoon or, you know, we could sit in the hot tub at night, like that's all I wanted. And if I could be around yarn, I mean, come on, like I just couldn't imagine. And I like people, so I couldn't imagine a better lifestyle. I was telling you that our growth has happened. You know, I played sports. In particular, I ran. So I've always, again, I've been a runner, and I've always been competitive, but never with anybody else. I've always been, I'm my biggest critic, and I've always been a competitor, you know, with myself. So if I ran, you know, the half mile in 2 minutes and 30 seconds, then the next day I need to run it in 2:29. And it was the same kind of thing with the business. I mean, the very first time we got an order, well, so we opened the shop, and then we decided we would build a website because that's what we knew how to do, and this was in 2002, and because we thought it might help supplement the store sales. Again, we're in a tourist town where 80% of the population are second homeowners. So we thought that, we were like, dang, man, we're smart. You know, we'll do this since we don't have a big population here. And the first time we got an order, I mean, I called Doug, and I was just, like, over the moon. I was like, oh, my God, somebody ordered. Somebody ordered, like, somebody placed an order. It was the most magical feeling ever, you know, to know that somebody that may not even know you just, like, gave you their credit card. Like, it was so cool. And I was like, what do I do? What do I do? He's like, well, why don't you sell it and ship it to them? I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. So I filled it and I shipped it. And then the next day, you know, actually that night, we sit in the hot tub and we're just like, what if we got an order every single day? Like, could you imagine? Could we, you know, at some point we got about one a week, and then we got two a week, and then we eventually got seven a week. And so it's just been a natural progression like that. Then you'd get two or three or four orders one day and think, oh, my God, what if we got two or three or four orders every day? And so then we would just work extra hard. You know, we'd add more pictures. We'd start sending out newsletters. We'd do whatever we could do to try and encourage that to happen. And mostly, I mean, I still feel like this. I can't really control whether or not people want to buy from us. Or I'm not going to go to your house, Benjamin, and say, okay, you're shopping for yarn. Why don't you buy from us? All I can do is control the experience that you have when you do make that decision. And so that's what I did, I guess, kind of instinctively in the beginning was placed an order. I tried to fill that order within like 10 minutes, and I would close the shop, and not literally, but, you know, I'd run over to the post office and drop it off and send them an email immediately and say, it's on its way. And that instant kind of service, I guess, again, looking back, was the only thing that I had any control over, and that created referrals, that created word-of-mouth business, that created the desire for people to want to order more than anything else. And that's still our thought. I mean, that's still all we do. I mean, that's all we have control over.
Well, and it's the right way of looking at the whole thing. People can chase that a long time, but, you know, if you have zero attrition because the experience is so great, I mean, it's much more cost-effective to keep a customer and have them come back than to get a new customer, as you and I both know. But we're talking about you getting online and doing e-com in 2002. And back then, I think we all thought, well, this internet thing might catch on at some point. But that's yeah. really, I mean, that's really early. I mean, I, as you know, I have another company, Hopscotch Web, where I try to work with local yarn stores that don't have e-com now. And the world of 2002 compared to the world of 2014 is radically different. I mean, in order to have a shopping cart and the experience you're talking about, I mean, that's hard code. I mean, there weren't modules you could go get. I mean, you guys got
right.
in really, really early.
Yes, we did. And it's just pure luck. I mean, it's pure luck and pure timing. And it's just lucky that that was the background that we had, you know, so we didn't have to hire anybody. I mean, we just did it ourselves. I'll go to business classes locally and talk to, like, I've got an MBA class coming to our place tonight. And they'll be like, what kind of advice do you have? I'm like, I don't know, be lucky. You know, get lots of fortune cookies or something, because there's nothing that you can do to replicate it. It was just pure magic that all happened at the same time. Because if we'd made that decision today, we wouldn't stand a chance.
Well, I don't know about that. I think that there's always room for a good online store. I mean, it would have been different,
oh,
but
sure.
It's not like you opened the doors and were instant millionaires. You worked at this for several years, and let's talk about your growth. I mean, as you started out, you were employee number one, and you stayed the only employee there for a while before you started to grow.
Yes. Yeah. I think maybe after a year or, you know, I don't remember exactly, but sometime like towards the second year, I ended up, and I guess I should see if there's a statute of limitations. Oh, this was more than 7 years ago, so I think I'm okay IRS-wise. But, you know, I had my first employee, and I would trade her for yarn, as many local yarn shops do, which I think is highly illegal. But, again, I think I'm past the statute, hopefully. Anyway, so, you know, I had a woman that would come in a few, maybe 10 hours a week or something, just to give me a little bit of a break, because I think I was working 7 days a week, you know, six or seven, I'm sure. And then about 2 years into it, we finally decided to expand. And, you know, we had hit the scarf craze. I don't remember how many orders we were getting online, but maybe it was 25 a day. You know, it was significant, and it started to become more than just one person could handle. I mean, I was literally standing there at the cash register, customers coming in. I've got my little teeny Canon camera. I'm taking pictures of yarn, uploading the pictures, would get an order, trying to run and grasp. Literally, like, you know, somebody would be looking at a ball of yarn, and I'd have to yell, "No, somebody just ordered that. Can I have that one back here? You'll like this one instead." and then I'd, you know, ship that out. Great customer service. Ship that one out and, you know, doing all that yourself. So eventually we decided to open a second shop, and we opened one in Reno. And then that's when, you know, the growth really happened, I guess, in that now all of a sudden I had a store manager. You know, I had other employees that I had to work with that even when I wasn't there. So I really had to stretch kind of my managerial, I had zero managerial skills, and it really showed. For a long, long, long time. I think it still shows, but so then, you know, we got to about $1 million in sales, which I can't even tell you how proud I was of that. And we stayed there for a number of years, and really learned kind of how to run a small business.
You did, and we talked a little bit about the sensibilities of what you carry. And I'd like to just, you know, back up and talk not exactly what you carry, but the sensibilities of what you carry. For our listeners, what is it that makes it onto the shelves and the website of Jimmy Beans Bowls?
95% of the time, every once in a while we'll slip, but 95% of the time, we buy stuff. We have a philosophy in the shop that, okay, if, you know, let's say the internet thing does not end up working out for any of us, and our business just goes down and we go out of business, we all want to be left with a stash that we want to work through for the rest of our lives. So I'm not going to buy it unless I want to knit with it personally, or one of the girls, you know, has a passion for it and she wants to work with it personally. Because then that way, I mean, we feel real comfortable. If it doesn't sell, who cares? You know, if you guys don't want it, that's no problem because we'll use it. And that's what we end up doing. So that's kind of our litmus test, I guess.
Well, and you and I talked about this as well, and I think it's a smart thing. You know, salesmanship 101, the first sale you make is to yourself. If you guys love it, it's going to be easier for you to get your customers to love it too. It makes sense to me.
Sure. I'd like to say, you know, again, I wasn't really joking when I said, you know, how did I learn so much? It's by watching people like you, because I had no idea that that was the case. I mean, everything that we have done as a business, you know, I started to get a little business smarter. In the last couple of years, you know, I've read more business books and stuff, but everything else has just been intuition. So, I guess so. That's a really good one. I never realized that was the case. I just thought, if I go to business, at least I'll like the stuff I've got.
Well, I like the fact that as you go through this, you've got that plan B, which is if it doesn't work out, you know, I've started over before, I can start over again, and what's the worst case scenario? That's a good way to look at it. But along the way, you had a couple of great breaks that happened for you. You had a magazine come in, and you got some marketing advice. Can you tell our listeners kind of that story? Because that was kind of a big deal for you guys.
That was a huge deal for us. I mean, that's what turned us around. We've had two big pivot points, I suppose, and we're on our third one right now. And that first one was Fortune Small Business, the magazine that would go out to business members of Costco. And I sent them a note. I had seen another business profiled in their magazine that I had been familiar with, that I was a customer of once. And I was just like, well, if they can get profiled, then why can't we get profiled? I mean, there's, like, why not? Like, I'm a customer of theirs, and they're great, but they're not untouchable. You know, they're not unreachable. So I sent a note to Fortune Small Business. I called them up and said, hey, yarn is really pretty. It would look really pretty in your magazine. It's really, you know, and everybody knits. And so I pulled out all kinds of stats and said, look at how many people you'll be reaching, and everybody's going to think it's interesting, and blah, blah, blah. They said yes. So they did what they called a makeover of us, and they sent somebody from Google. They sent a strategist from Deloitte & Touche, and they sent a public relations firm owner, Darcy Provo, to come visit and spend a day with us and just kind of teach us, guide us through business 102, if you will. And the combination of the exposure that we got through being, you know, 5 pages of this major magazine, and then the lessons that they taught us, I mean, that just, man, that put a fire in our belly. And we were just stoked, you know, and just once again started working our butts off and really taking it to heart. And that's when we went from, you know, we just started getting into rapid growth mode. So, you know, 1 million to 2.5 to 3.5 to 4.5 to 5.5, just kept pushing and pushing. So that was, it was invaluable. So for any of you guys that have businesses or thinking about having businesses, getting public advice like that is just, again, it's phenomenal, and it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, not just because you're getting publicity, but because you're getting the advice, and the advice tends to be very sound. You know, and then it's up to you what you do with it. I mean, that's obviously just the first part of it, which was one of the lessons. You know, it's not enough to just get the exposure. It's not enough to get the advice. It's the most important part is what you do with it afterwards.
Well, I absolutely agree with that. And then, you know, so you're on this big, you know, growth spurt. And I kind of know what that was. We went through a growth spurt, too, once upon a time. And, you know, I know what that's like, too. Money is coming in. You're changing infrastructure. You opened up a distribution center, and you're hiring people like crazy. I mean, some of the times the way you handle this is you just keep throwing bodies at it. And it's very difficult. I mean, all of a sudden, you're no longer dealing with your customers. You're becoming a full-time dealing with personnel issues, which has never been my favorite thing to do. And you've learned a lot. I mean, all of a sudden, you're in a $5 million company. You've got, what, over 40 people working for you. This is a brand new kind of animal now. And, you know, this whole slowing down of the lifestyle thing pretty much is abandoned by that time. So how do you deal with it? I mean, you know, let's talk about your business philosophies. How do you deal with the idea of getting the right people and building a team and dealing with it all?
That's a great question. You know, how we deal with it today is obviously it's evolution. So it's obviously significantly different than how we dealt with it 5 or 8, 10 years ago. One pivotal moment was when we had our son. When we had him, you know, before we had him, I was working 7 days a week. I mean, we were working the equivalent of 8 or 9 days a week. And we actually had a great lifestyle because we would work at home a lot. And so I would run in the morning or run in the middle of the day and go for a 2-hour run and had a lot of balance. But I would also work from 6 in the morning till 8 or 9 or 10 p.m. And it would just be broken up. But when we had our son, you know, to this day, you know, one of my biggest issues is I feel incredible guilt that I don't work enough because I don't leave the house until 8:30 or 9. I mean, he gets up at 5 in the morning and we play until 7:30 or 8. I leave work at 5 o'clock, so I'm not putting in even the standard 8 hours anymore. But the unexpected benefit to that was because of the choices that we've made and because we have chosen to, you know, only let our son be watched by somebody else for 7 or 8 hours a day, if you will, and we're very lucky that we can choose that, the side effect was that I had to learn how to let go. And because if we wanted the same amount of work to get done, then I had to learn how to communicate to other people stuff that previously I had just done myself. So managerial skills just grew exponentially as a result of him. But in terms of, you know, today, I'm lucky enough that, you know, after a few years, we found somebody that is a great manager. She's a phenomenal personnel manager and process manager. So I don't really have to worry about it at all because she's so good at it. And now what I worry about and what she and I work together on is when we do hire people, trying to figure out, and this is one of the greatest lessons that we've learned over the last year, is how do we find people that are a culture fit? And for us, the first thing was, who are we? You know, and as you grow that much and you grow that quickly and you have life changes, you know, you have a son that's born, you've got 2 dogs that die within 6 months of each other, which they were our best friends. You know, we had a lot of emotional ups and downs for a couple of years. And so that really kind of changed, you know, really challenged, you know, our identity as a company and as a family and everything else. But what we've kind of come to today is our whole business philosophy, and I hate to even say it because it's just so instinctual and it's intuitive, is the bottom line is if you're going to work for us or work with us, whether it's a vendor, whether you're an employee, whether you're a customer, whatever, if you want to be part of, if we're going to be together, you have to have a fundamental respect for other human beings. And there's no other way to say it. I mean, you have to, my belief is that every single person in the world has equal value. And some of us are good at math. Some of us are good at art. Some of us are good at cooking. Some of, you know, there's, and not a single thing that you're good at. Some of us are simply good at making other people smile. You know, I've got a couple people that are fantastic people, and I swear, this sounds silly, but the thing that they bring to the business the most is every time I walk by them, they make me smile. And I, you can't put a value on that. And I just, it's positive energy, and it's fantastic. So that's what we've kind of come down to. If you come to work for us, and, you know, customers have bad days, and they call, and they're angry or upset with us, and most of the time they should. If you can't step back and realize that that customer is a person, too, and has a life, too, and has stuff going along, too, and cut them some slack, then you're not going to be a good fit, and that you guys feel the same way about your coworkers. You know, we can't all have good days every day, and every single person has value, no matter if they're, no matter what their job is. So, does that kind of answer? That's a long-winded answer.
Well, it's a great answer. You had said something when we were doing our pre-interview about the way that you hire people, not necessarily based on skill, and this ties into it. And, you know, do you remember what you said to me?
I probably just said that you can teach anybody anything.
Yes.
And that's not what we're concerned with. And that's a lesson that we've had to learn, you know. I mean, for a while we were trying to hire based on skill. And now we realize, you know, one of the things we ask people is, what do you suck at? And it's really important for me to know what you suck at. And there's no shame in it, you know. And I'm like, if you're late every day, cool, that's fine. Like, I'm not here to try to change who you are. Then we'll just adapt the schedule so that, you know, we tell you you need to be here at 10:15, but we really don't expect you here till 10:30. That is a whole lot easier and a whole lot more productive than you spending every morning struggling, trying to make it to work on time. If your nature is to not be on time, I'm okay with that. You know, we're not a hospital where we've got surgery or, you know, we're shipping yarn orders out. So anyway, yeah, that's kind of our philosophy. I'm a work-arounder kind of person.
I think it's very smart, and that you do get the right people, and you get people that want to be there. I want to step back for a second because you brought it up. You became a mom, and I know this has affected a lot of what you do. He shows up on your website from time to time, and he has the greatest name. For our Fiber Hooligan listeners, will you please tell us your son's name and how that name came about?
Yeah. His name is Huckleberry, as in Huckleberry Finn. Yes, yes, yes. You know, Doug and I, when I got pregnant, we didn't know what to do. We had never thought about any names. We never thought about having a kid, to be quite honest. And one day Doug comes home and says, "What do you think about the name Huck?" And I'm like, "You're kidding me." He's like, "What?" I was like, "I was thinking the exact same thing today." And at that moment, we were like, "Okay, done." I mean, it's kind of like Diane saying Jimmy Bean's wool works. We're like, done, that's it. And then the only discussion we had was, should we name him Huck, like on his birth certificate, or should we go for it and just name him Huckleberry? And we decided we were just going to go for it. And it was, you know, for us, like A Boy Named Sue, the old song, you know, hopefully he would have the personality to back it up. Because if not, you'd have to go with his middle name. And he does.
Oh, it's a great name, and you know he's a you know, I've met him, of course. He's a beautiful little boy, and I understand that, you know, you take the time and that he skis. You take him skiing.
Yep, yeah, he's on the ski team. He can surf. He's, you know, everything. I mean, he's super, super active. He's like me on steroids. He's crazy, really crazy.
Well, it's great that you make him part of your world, and he, you know, I've seen him at Fiber events with you, and he just seems very comfortable around that world too, which I think is pretty great.
Oh, he loves it. He comes to the warehouse. I mean, all he wants to do is come to the warehouse, and all he wants to do is work. You know, so he'll come in and he'll pull orders, and you know, everybody that works there knows him, and he hops on one of the carts, and they push him around, and they'll tell him what to pull, and he pulls it, and he puts stuff away, and you know, he knows. We say, I mean, if we don't go to work today and we can't make money, we can't buy toys. So he's always like, "Mom, do I have to go to school today? Can't I just go to work so we can buy some toys? So, yeah, he gets it.
And I understand that he is, I mean, you know, you do multiple crafts, but I understand you're doing some crafting with him. I think it's sewing that his big...
Yeah, I just learned how to sew about 2 years ago. I bought a sewing machine, and, you know, I would love to knit with him, but given both of our personalities, it just doesn't work yet. So sewing, oh, my gosh, we make strip quilts because he literally lays on the floor, and if he thinks it's really funny, he'll put his butt on the pedal, and then he, like, hops up and down, and, you know, he knows, or he'll put his head on the pedal, and he'll push the pedal to make the needle go. And we'll sew strips of stuff. And he's gotten really good at it because I can say, okay, I need 2 slow stitches. Now I need to backstitch, you know, and then he'll be like, Mom, can I go fast now? I'm like, yep, fire it up, you know, and he goes as fast as he can. And then he gives me an excuse because when people see my quilts and the stitches are uneven, I can just say, well, my son did it. You know, what do you expect? No, it's really my fault.
Well, he's a cute kid, and I'm glad he's getting into the business. Maybe we'll see another generation there, you know, a second generation coming in. I know that that's something, it's an unfair thing for parents to have an expectation, but it's always a nice thing when it does happen. So I'm sure he'll be a credit to you no matter what he ends up doing.
Yeah.
Did I lose you there?
No, sorry. A big truck just drove by. I'm sitting outside.
No problem. This is totally fine.
Yeah, he loves it. He just does. And we love having him be a part of it. I mean, it really makes the whole thing a big family. And it's so cool that he has like 40 surrogate moms, you know, and surrogate dads and everybody that works there. I mean, it's just it's a really cool feeling that he comes in and he's like, hi, Terry. Hi, Jill. Hi, Jeannie. You know, and everybody knows who he is.
That's very cool. All right, let's move back on, and I want to talk about something that's pretty recent. You've been a successful business owner for a long time. You've been recognized for your company's excellence and growth. You know, in between 2007 and 2012, you know, you had an annual rate of growth that was as much as 50% every year, which is unbelievably it's amazing. But you've also had some challenges along the way, and there was a very revealing and candid article in the New York Times Online a little over a month ago. I read it and was astounded by how candid and revealing it was, and I'm wondering if you'd be willing to talk about that article and what you went through with our Fiber Hooligan listeners.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I can tell you the short story, I suppose, or kind of the backstory to it is, you know, we had a tough summer. Our growth stopped for the first time ever in the first time at least since maybe 2005 in June. And it really struck us. I mean, we were like, wow, you know, this has never happened. Okay, well, this must be temporary. You know, we'll just keep doing what we're doing. And in July, our growth still stopped. We were maybe 1% up or flat or something along those lines. And the problem was our expenses. So we had hired, you know, we had some employees, and so we had some high-level employees that we had hired relatively recently. And we had purchased, for those of you guys that aren't yarn shop owners, you know that, you know, the new seasons, the new yarn collections come out, the fall one usually comes out in July and in August. So we had placed our orders for inventory based on 20% growth, and we ended up being flat. So cash flow-wise, you know, we had trouble. It was hard. We had lots of extra inventory, which, you know, if you know anything about business, I mean, you either have cash or you have inventory. And so we didn't have cash. We had the inventory because we had misjudged how much we were going to be doing. By August, it still didn't get any better. So we were like, okay, we need to really think about what's going on. And long story short, I ended up meeting, I had a SCORE business advisor. So this is a little bit of a fallacy in the story that was written, or a little bit of a misconception. I had a business advisor from SCORE, who's a free advisor. You know, there's SCORE chapters everywhere. And then I had joined a couple of women's groups, again, that were free groups that I was just a participant in. So I was getting advice from all of these guys, but we had never had paid consultants. We had never reached out to somebody to have kind of one-on-one advice given to us. And I ended up meeting a guy that we just hit it off. he's Southern, and he's from Atlanta. And we ended up hitting it off, and he came out in August. And we were talking about how great things had been for the last couple of years and then how they were just starting to slow down and what do we need to do. Anyway, long story short, you know, we had a couple of rough months, and it took us a couple of months, about 2 months, to figure out what to do about it and to recognize that it was not going to just bounce back the way that we thought it was going to bounce back. In the meantime, I had talked to a lot of people in the industry and had heard that other yarn shops were having trouble and the manufacturers were having trouble. So we were like, oh, you know, this might be kind of long-term. We need to reassess how much money we're spending on things. We need to reassess our inventory turnover. You know, we need to reassess. And we did. We had to lay some people off. We had to cut some inventory. And it was, you know, incredibly painful. We had never gone through it before. So the story came to be because I had met and become friends with an editor from the New York Times. He's a small business editor. And we were having lunch when I went to VK Live in New York, and I was telling him this. I'm like, oh, my God, like the irony. You know, here we were trying to grow, and I'm traveling, trying to figure out how to grow this business, and the growth stopped. Like, how funny is that? And he was just like, yeah, that's really funny. Can we write a story on it? And me, because I don't know how to keep my mouth shut, was just like, yeah, I mean, it's the truth. There's no shame in the truth. It's there. I mean, yeah, of course, I made lots of mistakes. This was tough, but that was yesterday. There's nothing I can do about it, and it's just the truth. So, I mean, we sat on the phone for hours and hours and hours and hours and kind of hashed through it. So that was the story. And, as you saw on Ravelry and on our page and on the New York Times page, it was like pitchfork mob. I mean, we got lots of people that were, you know, we had some really great supportive comments from a lot of people, and then a lot of people, you know, came at us and said, well, here, let me tell you why you're failing. I was like, oh, it was brutal. But it was fantastic. You know, it's the best thing that's ever happened to us, for sure.
It was very brave, and it was something that impressed me a lot, that you would go out there and again, really expose yourself. I mean, you equated it to, you know, taking off all your clothes and saying, hey, do I look bad? And how revealing and how vulnerable are you at that spot. It was just very brave. And I know I spoke to other people in the industry that read this, and you know, I don't think I'm that brave. I don't think that I would necessarily tell that story, but I was glad to read it. I talked to other people in the industry who have gone through those things, and they found a great deal of comfort, which was, oh, so it's not just me. This stuff does, so you did a good thing there.
Well, thank you. Thank you a lot. And I think that's one of my biggest frustrations in life, I guess, or I should say in society, is the lack of comfort sometimes and the lack of, and not all the time. I mean, there are a lot of people that aren't like this, but I want to know, you know, I don't remember if I was talking to you or somebody else. I mean, when I had my son, you know, the minute he came out, I'd heard was it's the most magical moment of your entire life. You know, you will look at him and fall in love instantly, and it's going to change everything. And man, when he came out, that was not the most magical moment of my life. I mean, it was horribly painful. And I did not fall in love with him right there. I was like, go, can't you put him in another room? I need to get some sleep. And I just remember I had one or two friends that had said, yeah, it's really tough. You know, or we found it really tough. Not everybody does. We all react to everything differently. Absolutely. And I fully appreciate that. But the people that comforted me the most were the ones that, not threw a pity party with me, but that said, dude, I felt exactly the same way. You're not alone. You know, you're not alone. And so I think one of the reasons that I'm just really open, because I want people to know that you're not alone. I always think of Paris Hilton. And I think about how we probably all look at her and think that she must be, or it used to, you know, when she was at her prime, at her height, how happy she must be and how just perfect her life is and how great it must be to be pretty and wealthy and da-da-da-da-da. And I think, I bet that girl's got problems. I bet she cries sometimes. I bet, you know, just because on the outside it looks like everything's going right doesn't mean that she's not a real person. It doesn't mean that she doesn't have feelings and problems. Her problems are just different. And so that's kind of one of my missions in life. Is to be vulnerable.
Well, and again, you do it in a way that is very real. And, you know, again, I was just incredibly impressed. And again, the reactions from people from the article, you know, from everywhere, there were some rough things that were said. I mean, unbelievably judgmental. And yet there were some things that were said, you know, especially by the fiber arts industry that I thought were incredibly supportive. And maybe this is a good time to talk about your feelings about the folks in the fiber arts industry.
Oh, it's the most, I am the luckiest person that has ever lived. I just never would have in a million years imagined that I would have ended up in an industry like this. And it is, as it's home, it's family, it's so supportive. I mean, our customers send us cookies. You know, our customers send us gifts. Our customers send us thank you cards. Our customers are kind enough or care enough to send a note and to say, hey, read the article, you know, X, whatever, good job, or here are some suggestions, or, you know, whatever. I mean, the fact that people would take the time out of their personal life to give input on something to help us become better is, it's just unreal. I mean, I just can't imagine that happens in the tire industry. You know, I can't imagine that when Michelin is having trouble that a bunch of Michelin customers send them cookies and say, you know, oh, you know what, it'll be okay. You guys are doing a great job. Just keep doing what you're doing, or whatever. Or when they come out with a new tire, I can't believe that they get on some forum and talk about how cool Michelin's new tire is and what good people they are. So, I mean, this is the most amazing industry that you could ever possibly be in. I honestly, and I don't say that flippantly, I can't imagine a better industry. I don't know what one could even be.
Well, and I think it shows. I've seen you at shows, both TNA and Stitcher shows, and you light up. I mean, you like being there. I can tell you like being there.
Yeah, the people are amazing, and that's what it all is about. Can you not love it? You're walking around with a bunch of yarn and just beauty. You know, you're walking around beauty, and for 99.9% of the people, nobody has a chip on their shoulder. Nobody's got anything to prove. We're all in it to, like, build stuff together, whether it's to build a sweater, whether it's to build some socks, and we all want to share. There's no competitiveness. You know, it's not who can make the prettiest sock. It's, holy cow, you just finished a sock? How cool is that? So it's the most kind of collaborative environment I've ever been in. It's really, really, really wonderful.
Well, I'm glad you said that. So one of the things that you did, you took this feedback to heart. I mean, you really did something with the feedback. Can you tell our fiber hooligans what your plan is to deal with, how you dealt with the feedback?
Yeah, I was pretty emotionally raw, and I knew that would be the case, and I was willing to accept that, but I knew it's what needed to be done. So I read some of the comments, and then eventually it just became kind of too destructive for me. You know, I couldn't sleep, and I'm crying all the time. And again, intellectually, I understand, you know, I got it, but you can only control your emotions so much. So I got it. So intellectually, how about this? Instead, let's have one of the other girls at the store who's not as close to it, who hasn't worked here for 12 years, and whose husband is not the software engineer that has written every single piece of code. So we had her go through every single comment, you know, and keep it and basically list out every suggestion, every criticism, you know, every piece of constructive criticism that she could muster. And then we sat down, and if you went in my office right now, you would see every page of our website blown up in color, pasted on our walls, and we are going through. My door has all kinds of stuff on it and all kinds of ideas, and we took all of those comments and are working on having the best website that has ever existed in the history of the yarn world, and we will by October. It's going to take us about 6 months. We've already started working on incorporating 99% of the comments that were left, and some of them are fantastic. A lot of them were fantastic. And a lot of them, you know, what was really interesting to me is we were already planning on it, you know, to be defensive about it. Doug and Emily and Monica, our software team now, they have been for the last 2 years, because our growth was so significant, they've been working on internal systems because we've built our inventory management system. We built our point of sale. So he's been doing all this stuff to make sure that, because what was most important is that when somebody places an order, we ship their package, you know, and we ship it quickly and we ship it correctly and all that kind of stuff. So we had a lot of groundwork to lay bare and a lot of things to update. So we were already preparing to revisit the external site, but we were off focus. If we hadn't put this article out, the changes that we would have made would have been the wrong changes. So I'm unbelievably grateful that our customers chimed in and said, no, you know what's really important is this. And we didn't realize that what they were saying was lacking was lacking. So it's really, really cool. I mean, it's one of the coolest feelings ever. Once I got done crying, I'm like, you know how it is. It's darkest before the dawn, and once you get done with it and you stand up and you're like, all right, let's do this, it's the coolest feeling that I've ever had. I mean, we're more excited now than we've been in years, years and years and years, and we're all in it together. It's really amazing.
And I think that's, you know, as I listen to you think, that's got to be your strategy as you move forward, is more energy, better experience, almost renewing vows with the industry and your customers.
Absolutely. That's a great way to put it. That's a really great way to put it. It's funny, we were going to talk about this in a bit, but, you know, that article, the reason I was in Atlanta is I was with the New York Times editor, and I'm actually going to start blogging for the New York Times in a couple of weeks. I'll be a weekly blogger on the small business site, about 10 of them, and kind of the premise of it is renewing our vows. You know, it's us going through every single part of our business and reassessing, okay, this worked great 5 years ago. The world has changed. Our customers have changed. Technology has changed. Does this still work today? And then going through everything from marketing to operations to health insurance to the way we handle refunds, the way we handle donation requests, I mean, all of that kind of stuff, and just reassessing our strategies and making sure that we're keeping up with things.
Well, that's that's wonderful news about your deal with the New York Times blog. Very exciting.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a dream come true. It's really neat. I'm so excited. So be prepared to read lots of more vulnerabilities and you know, I'm very open. So we're going to go through social media and all kinds of stuff. We'll just take everybody along on the journey and ask lots of questions because we'll, you know, with the site, say, what do you guys like better? Do you think this looks better or does this look better? So I'm looking forward to having a platform to get lots of feedback.
Well, I'm going to be tuning in for sure. I'm going to move off of this for just a minute, and let's move off your business a little bit. I want to talk to you about a very big campaign that you started a couple of years ago. Of course, I'm talking about Stitch Red. This has been an incredibly big thing that the fiber arts community has gotten behind. And for our listeners that may have missed it, I can't believe that you did. Will you talk a little bit about Stitch Red? Let's talk about what was the motivation for this. First of all, what is Stitch Red? For the listeners who have never heard of it before.
Stitch Red is a campaign that my husband and I, or that we put together a couple of years ago to raise awareness of heart disease in women. It's the number one killer of women in the United States, and obviously women are our number one customer base. So what we did is we gathered together attempted to gather together as many vendors and participants in our industry as we could and get them all to support the same campaign, all use the same website, all use the same terms, all use the same logo, and we figured that if we could get everybody together under the same umbrella, that we could create a lot of power. And we could really get women to think about their health decisions, you know, or their lifestyle, and really make them aware of heart disease and the issues that stem from it.
Well, okay, so now we have the what it is, but there's a good story about what your motivation was and how you originally got interested in this project. Would you share that with us?
Sure. 5, 6, 7 years ago, I think, Doug, he was 35 at the time, he went to the doctor for his checkup and came home and said that they want to put me on blood pressure medicine. And we're like, he's 35, you know, and we're outdoorsy and we eat well and we have an active, healthy lifestyle, or so we thought. And so I didn't accept that. and thought, okay, there's got to be something that we could do in our life. Let's take a look at what we're doing in our lifestyle and see if there's anything we can change. And I realized that although we didn't go out to eat and although I cooked all the time and I would spend time cooking, I was using too many processed foods. And I was using too much soup in a can, you know, as the base of a casserole or something. Using, you know, Linder's bagels, all of these things, macaroni and cheese, they all have high sodium. And so I just switched I still shopped at Safeway, but changed my grocery store buying habits to not buy stuff that has, you know, that's been processed. And we got his blood pressure down low enough that he didn't have to go on blood pressure medication. And so right around that time, a sales rep came in to visit. Her name was Marta McGinnis, and I was telling her about this, and we talked, and she said, you know, I have heart disease. I just had a heart attack, and she was about 50. I'm like, wow. So we started talking, you know, over time, and let's do something about it. And she's like, let's do a book. Let's do Knit Red, and we'll get celebrities in the this was after the Breast Cancer Celebrity Scarves book. You know, let's get people in our industry to create patterns and da-da-da-da. So we started to kind of brainstorm and work on it a little bit together. We had lunch one day, and then I think about 2 days later, she died from heart disease. So I just let it sit, you know, of course, as you can imagine, for a couple of years. And then picked it back up, had an employee who had just started to work for us that had nonprofit background, and she wanted to pick it up or was willing to pick it up and run with it again. And so we put a book proposal together for Knit Red and then decided let's make this a whole campaign and let's see if we can make this bigger than just a book and let's see what we can do. And so, you know, we did. We came up with a Stitch Red concept and reached out to people like you and said, would you be willing to support this? We'll do all the work. You know, we'll create the website. We'll create all the postcards. We'll do everything. But, you know, if you're willing to spread the word, that would be fantastic. And or if you're, like in your case, you were willing to give us booths at the Stitches events so that we could just go and promote it, you know, and just tell people about it. You know, and cheekily, I always just said, well, we're just trying to get our customers to live longer so they can buy more yarn. You know, I mean, this isn't too altruistic. Don't worry about it. but, yeah, I mean, it's been going on for a few years, and we've heard anecdotally, I mean, every time we go to an event, we just get woman after woman after woman who tells us a story, you know, of somebody in their family or in their life or themselves. So we think it's made a difference.
Well, I think it has made a difference. And, again, the industry has adapted this, you know, pretty strongly. I was there at TNNA. During the Yarn Group meeting where you talked about it, and there was enthusiasm and acceptance in the room. It wasn't like, oh, you know, okay. It was like, you know, oh, heck yeah, we're in. And you started working with, well, first of all, let's give props to the folks over at Soho for the books. But you also started working with a lot of suppliers on Stitch Red Red products. Let's talk about those products a little bit. You don't have to give us all, but can you give us kind of a highlight and a sampling and what was involved in creating and contributing a Stitch Red product?
Sure. You know, this all kind of started, we got our first vote of confidence from Debbie Bliss, who has heart disease, issues, issues with her heart. And I think her grandfather, and I'm not going to say this right, but I think her grandfather died at like 37, you know, and it's run in her family for a long time. She was the first one to say, I'm in, done. I mean, this obviously, no pun intended, but, or pun intended, really hits close to my heart. And so she said, we have a new yarn coming out. I think it was Rialto. And I've got a red. She showed me the shade card. She's like, can I call this my Stitch Red color? We were like, great, awesome. So she put Stitch Red on the label. She donated 5%, you know, of every ball that was sold back to the Heart Truth to raise awareness. And she wrote about it in the Debbie Bliss magazine, you know, multiple times. She did a design for the book. I mean, she did, and this was everybody, Noragon and Barocco, you know, again, like you guys, and Lantern Moon came up with a whole series of products, and Lorna's Laces, and it was really, really powerful and really wonderful.
Yeah, it was, and it moved on from just the knitting. You know, you went into Sew Red. Let's talk about the other avenues that you went through as well.
Yeah, we had grand dreams, grand visions of making this a campaign that would spread across you know, be a multi-craft campaign. So go into the sewing world, go into embroidery, go into anything. Again, I mean, you know, 98%, I'm just making that up, but I guess 98%, 99% of our customers are women. And so we reached out to the sewing community and to the quilting community and said, do you guys want to be involved in this? And for their book, they said yes. And then we reached out, you know, to crocheters, and we came out with the third edition called Crochet Red that just came out a couple of months ago, and that one turned out beautifully as well. But, you know, our goal is, again, it was Stitch Red. So no matter how you stitch, Stitch Red, I guess.
You were very candid with me on the pre-interview, looking back at the campaign, unbelievably successful, you know, probably one of the largest philanthropic and charity campaigns ever done in the industry. But you did have some self-criticism. Would you like to share that with our group?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, if I, you know, I don't see it as being tremendously successful. I think we could have done a much better job. And I know hindsight's always 20/20, but knowing that hindsight's 20/20, when I look back, you know, I didn't realize one of the avenues that we thought could help create awareness the most, I guess, is through the local yarn shops. You know, so we had these grand visions of local yarn shops having Stitch Red knit nights where people would come in and they would knit with red stuff, and maybe the owners would charge $5 per head, and then that $5 goes to the Heart Truth. You know, having a table full of red products and you know, really letting everybody know about it. And the local yarn shops just didn't grab on. I mean, a few of them did, but most of them didn't. And obviously, in hindsight, you know, why would they if they think that this is just something that's been benefiting Jimmy Beans, you know, something to raise awareness not of Stitch Red or of heart disease, but of Jimmy Beans wool. So if we could have done it again, I would have done it more anonymously. You know, we had a portal for yarn shops that wanted to get involved, and we had all kinds of marketing materials, and we didn't have our logos on any of it, but that wasn't enough. We should have left our logo off of the Stitch Red website. We should have, you know, made sure, and I don't know if that would have made a difference or not, but, you know, if I could do it all over again, we would have tried for one more layer of anonymity and tried to keep our name out of it a little bit more, you know, in hopes that it would have spread a little bit farther.
Well, I think it's not like you went into this and, you know, you had a degree in how to do this. You just wanted to help, and I think you did do the right thing. I mean, you know, you start things, and along the way you learn along, you know. This is something you and I have talked about, which is the concept of being good stewards of the industry. You know, first of all, we're in the yarn business. Don't take it too seriously. That's the first thing. The second thing, and you and I have talked about this, is that no one needs what we do to survive on a day-to-day basis. And we live in essentially a luxury world, and giving back and it is really important. And I know you feel the same way.
I do. Yeah, I do. I mean, I believe that we're all in this together, and it's all, you know, kind of, it's all one big community. And I kind of see, you and I were talking about, I mean, I'm a big believer in, I mean, one of the PR, the publicity reasons for doing Stitch Red was I was really hoping that the mainstream media would pick up on it as, look what this cool yarn industry is doing, you know, and we would get, I mean, actually, originally, I haven't mentioned this in a long time, my original thought with the book from a publicity standpoint was I wanted women to walk in, or men, you know, I wanted people to walk into Barnes & Noble, if you will, and see Knit Red, this beautiful cover on the end cap, see the raising awareness of heart disease, pick it up and think, you know, I learned how to knit when I was 12. I haven't done it in a really long time. Thumb to the back, see all these beautiful things you could make, and then go to the back and see that there was a how-to-knit guide, pick up the book, and go home and start knitting again. And I thought, you know, this is everything that we do has a goal of trying to create more awareness of knitting and of yarn and how cool it is and how fun it is. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess that's kind of the stewardship, is always trying to grow the industry, not trying to I'm happy if we have the same market share that we've always had or have the same whatever percent. But if we grow the industry, then we'll naturally grow as a side effect, which is the fun part. Again, because I'm an athlete. You know, if I did 230 one day, I want to do 229. I want to go a little faster. Not for any other reason than just because.
Well, and so you and I absolutely agree about this. So I should ask, what's the next thing for Stitch Fred? Is there another chapter another evolution in this campaign?
You know, I don't know. I think that's a great question, and that's something that is kind of on our docket and might end up being a blog post. You know, we started this 3 years ago. It's kind of fizzled out a little bit. Do we keep it going? Do people still want us to keep it going? If we do keep it going, what do we do to keep it going? And really figuring out, or are our resources better spent somewhere else, raising awareness of something else? And I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I would love anybody's feedback on what they think, because we're happy to do, you know, whatever the right thing is to do. We just want to make sure that, you know, we're spending our time wisely.
All right, Fiber Hooligans, it sounds like, you know, you need to give us some feedback here, and we'll talk later on about where that feedback can go. All right. So I guess my big question here is regardless of whether there's energy for it or there's a fizzling out, you know, there's always an apex for any campaign. I guess the real question is there still a need, and is this still the number one killer of women?
That's a good question. And, yes, I believe it is still the number one killer of women. We weren't that successful.
Well, I guess my thought is that as long as there's still a need, even if it's maybe not, it's going to be a slow growing, probably it should be continued.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's exactly what I needed to hear. That's a really great way to put it, and that's a really great way to think about it. So now the question is, you know, what do we do next? Which is a great question, and it's just something we need to think about. You know what, actually, I'm glad that you mentioned that. We have been talking to an organization called Heart Scarves, and I think it's Women's Heart. And so we've talked about putting a kit together, you know, that's a scarf kit that you can then – one of the things that was missing from the Stitch Red campaign is, what about people out there who want to knit red things to give to people? You know, there was no outlet for giving finished knitted items. There was only an outlet to give money. And so we are having conversations and partnering with an organization so that there will be an outlet if people want to make red scarves and give them to women who have had heart disease, which I think is just kind of a natural side effect. So I guess that's probably what we'll be doing to kind of re-energize things over the rest of this year.
Cool. Well, you know, let me know so I can see if I can help in any way. There's something parenthetical that I wanted to talk about, because we say all the time when referring to the yarn industry, knitting, and there, of course, is a lot of, you know, knit versus crochet animosity out there. I think more so by the crocheters. They feel like they are disrespected by knitters, and in some ways they feel disrespected by the industry and some yarn stores. And I wanted to make sure that Fiber Hooligans know that, if anything, you're probably more of a crocheter than a knitter, and you certainly don't feel that way.
No, I don't feel that way at all. Yeah, I learned how to crochet since Huck's been born. I mean, I've probably knit two things, but I've crocheted probably 10 or 20. I love it. I think it's, yeah, I mean, I really love it. And all of our skiers, you know, we're involved with the ski team, and, you know, when we had the shop in Truckee, Myth, everybody, they're all crocheting beanies. And to be honest, you know, I kind of stick my head in the sand, I guess, sometimes. I mean, I live in my own little world. I don't look at competitors' websites. I don't get involved in a lot of stuff like that. So it always surprises me when I hear that, because I don't think that way, and we don't think that way. I mean, we all do all of it, and we always say, I don't care what you do with the yarn. And I think that both are art forms. I think one, I had a harder time, and I've always had a more difficult time with crochet, because I think it is a little more, is it left brain, artistic? So knitting is easier for me to get my head around, because it's more, I don't know that it's more mathematical, but I mean, I can't even draw a stick figure. So sometimes the free formness of crochet is hard for me. But I don't know, they're both, yeah, they're both equal, and I guess I just kind of say knitting because. I don't know why.
Yeah, well, we all do it, but I just wanted to make sure that Barbara Hooligans knew out there that the Jimmy Beans Wools and Laura Zander is not a knitting shop. It's a yarn shop. And
it's a yarn shop.
By the way,
Yeah. It's equal fiber opportunity. Yeah.
Equal fiber opportunity. I like the way you said it. I'm gonna steal that one from you, okay?
Great. It's yours.
All right. Well, and speaking of yarn, let's you know, 99% of your business, I understand, is online sales. I think I got that right. Am I right about that?
I think it might be 98% right now. Our retail store sales are growing, but yeah.
Okay. Prior to the interview, I was up on your website. I've been there lots of times. And you have a lot of inventory on your site, of course. But what struck me were some of the other things that I saw on your site, creative things, like your yarn boutiques and gift baskets. They really are very creative and just good ideas. And since we're so close to Mother's Day, I'd love it if you could tell our listeners a little bit about these cool little the gift ideas, because they're really imaginative. And, you know, again, more fun than just sending somebody a skein of yarn. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. We'd say our internal motto, which we've been told not to publicize, so don't tell anybody that I said this, but is flowers dye. Yarn dies. D-Y-E-S. Get it? Ha-ha. But yarn lives forever. And we just figure, we started doing these yarn bouquets. We went to a gala event the other night. I wore the one dress that I own, and Doug wore the one pair of pants and dress shirt that he owns. And they put yarn bouquets on all the tables instead of putting flower bouquets. And I think I told you that we're going to sponsor a PGA event, and they at the dinner are going to have yarn bouquets on everything because it's just fun and it's different. And why not either have something like, if you love yarn, wouldn't it be fun to have a bouquet of yarn that matches your decor in your house, on your fireplace, on your table? And or isn't it fun? I mean, it's kind of an alternative to edible arrangements. I love flowers too, I mean, but I think that there's a place for all of it. So it's funny, actually, the Huffington Post sent a note the other day because they were looking for, they're doing an article on flowerless bouquets, and they called and said, hey, we found your yarn bouquets. How fun. Can we write about them? We were like, yes, please. Definitely. But, yeah, we just think it's fun. And, you know, again, kind of along the same lines of how we buy our inventory, we create things that we would want ourselves. And that's the bottom line, because then if we end up with a whole bunch of them, at least we have stuff that we like.
Well, see, I think you're missing a whole marketing opportunity with these things. You need to be positioning these things as, you know, hey, ladies, here's a way to put your stash out in the middle of the table and call it art and decoration. I think that's how you need to sell that into there.
That's a great idea. That's a really – okay,
no,
thank you.
No hiding it in the ceiling tiles or under the bed, you know, it's
yeah.
It's decor. That's the way to market that. I think that would go over well. All right.
I like it.
So let's make sure that we give our listeners a place where they can go take a look at those in case they haven't seen these beautiful yarn bouquets and gift baskets. And again, remember, Mom's Day is coming up. So where can they go and find that, Laura?
Just go to jimmybeanswool.com/gifts. Or if you go to our website, you know, one of the tabs at the top says gifts, G-I-F-T-S. And then that will kind of lead you to the towers, to the baskets, to the bouquets. And I will ask you to be patient with us. And like I said, we are redoing some stuff and making search better and doing all kinds of stuff, but it won't be completely done until October. So just bear with us right now and know that we are going to be making it better.
Well, I was up there. I thought it was great. I mean, their store is really well done. I mean, you've got the similar products. You've got about the product. And even a tab down there, so if there's a video that accompanies the product, it's available sort of in the interface. So I think you've got a lot going on that's pretty great.
Well, you're sweet. Thank you very much. I needed that.
No problem. I mean, technology is hard. Interface design is hard. I know about that. So is there anything kind of new and cool on your website that I've forgotten to tell our listeners about that's timely?
Oh, that's a great question. We're doing a mystery KAL right now that's based on the Game of Thrones, and I think that just started today or yesterday, whatever today is, April 25th, 6th, 7th. I think it's April, right?
So
28th. Okay. Yep. That's it. You know, I would just keep watching pictures. You know, we just Doug and Emily just added the ability to have multiple photos for each product. So we are slowly going through, well, we're going as fast as we can, but we are working our way through every single product and taking multiple versions, you know, multiple pictures from multiple angles of everything in their big, huge photos. So know that that's on the way, and you'll be able to see it. We're bringing on the yarn Anzula in a couple of weeks, and so that'll be the first case of a whole yarn line that's going to start out and come out with a bang, you know, that's going to have all these gorgeous photos. So that, and then, you know, Instagram and Facebook. I mean, Instagram, and again, if you feel like reading the New York Times post, the first few posts are actually going to be about Instagram, which I think is really relevant to our world because we're all about beauty and we're all about pretty pictures. So we have been, I've been really digging deep and trying to understand Instagram and understand the tools. And so for those of you out there that are indie dyers or, you know, are trying to make a living from yarn at all or trying to make a living from anything, maybe pop in and read that and see if there's anything useful. I'm going to give you a toolbox and all that kind of stuff.
Well, that's great.
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
I was going to say, sorry, it sounds like somebody wanted you there for a second. I got a question in the chat room, and they wanted me to ask you about the Jimmy Beans Only colors from Lorna's Laces. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, we've been doing those every month for the last, maybe 5, 6, 7 years. And this month was the Game of Thrones. We just work really closely with Beth, the owner of Lorna's Laces, to come up with those. So if anybody's ever got an idea or a suggestion or a colorway they'd like to see, please, please, please send it to us. My email is Laura, L-A-U-R-A, at jimmybeanswool.com. So just send me a note and say, hey, I want blue, red, green, and purple together, and I think it should be named Princess Bride, you know, or whatever. And then we just throw those at Beth. And this is what's so beautiful about, like, the fiber arts community is that you could send me that note. I'll send it to Beth. She'll dye up a little skein, you know, we'll send it over to you, and I mean, it's collaborative. It's so much fun. So in August, it'll be our anniversary of those colors, and we will, and as we've done a couple of times, we'll go back and vote on the favorite colors of the last 3 years and then vote a few of them into permanent existence. But it's been a wonderful relationship. Beth's like one of the best people in the entire world. You know that. She's just phenomenal.
What are you working on now, and what's new, and what's in store for the future? And you can talk about the stuff you're working on now, what you're going to be working on, as well as for you. We've already talked about the New York Times gig, so we don't have to talk about that. You're doing the website from Jimmy Beans Wools, but what else are you working on out there as far as just new and cool stuff? Because you're always working on something.
We are. Two things. One, we just signed a partnership with the High Fives Foundation, which is a foundation out of Tahoe, which is, you know, we have emotional attachments to. And they exist to help support athletes who have had life-changing, life-altering injuries. So, you know, primarily spinal cord injuries. So, and as part of that, they have a prevention arm, which is to encourage children and encourage people to wear helmets. And it's a hashtag helmets are cool. So as the mom of a 5-year-old boy who is already skiing and going in the half pipe and riding his bike and doing all of that, and knowing that, again, you know, the majority of our listeners have nieces and nephews and sons and granddaughters and family who should be wearing helmets, we've committed to every order that is placed, we'll donate a nickel, you know, 5 cents, to the High Fives Foundation, and then also include, you know, in that order some information about the High Fives and some encouragement to make sure that these kids are wearing helmets and that they just have it as part of their daily life, you know, or their outdoor life. So that's really exciting. We're going to do a hat drive with them, you know, in the fall where we encourage our customers to make hats, and then the High Fives can auction them off and all the money can go back to the High Fives for grants for kids and for advertising, you know, this helmets are cool. So we're doing that. And then in August or in late July, we're going to be one of the first ever yarn sponsors of a PGA event, and we – it's going to be co-sponsored by Juniper Moon Yarns. So the woman, Susan, who founded Juniper Moon, is going to come out and speak to 250 women about her life change and how she went from being, you know, from CNN to being a sheep farmer, if you will. And they're going to do also an annual, this will be the first of three annual long ball competitions at the PGA event, in which the ball is a ball of yarn. So we're really excited. We've got to get out there next month and start testing to really see how far you can hit a ball of yarn with a golf club. And then we got to figure out some techniques for how we're going to wind the ball of yarn. And I don't know, it's going to be fun. It'd be really neat.
And I understand you're always going out there and trying to look for ways to do outreach to other industries and people. And you told me kind of a goal that you're working on right now.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of where the PGA stuff comes in. I mean, what we've kind of decided is we will go out. I'm going to a Girl Scouts event next month. A few hundred Girl Scouts will be there, so working on that. We're working on a nurses program here in Reno, and we're just testing it out. So if anybody has any ideas, please email me or suggestions, especially if you're a nurse and understand that world. What we'd like to do is like offer, maybe we have, and for teachers as well, like nurses and teachers, free knitting classes 5 times a month or however often, where they can come in and we would love to give them the skills to be, and they can bring yarn from Walmart. I don't care. You know, it doesn't matter to me where you buy your yarn or what you've got. It doesn't matter if you want to knit or crochet or, again, do macrame. But the idea is to stay active and to be involved in it. So we're trying to figure out ways that we can help support the nursing community and the teaching community and get them involved with knitting, you know. And so trying to kind of develop those programs as well. I don't know where they'll go, but that's what's on the list right now.
Well, you and I were talking in our pre-interview, and one of the things that you wanted to do is you wanted to invite the Fiber Hooligan listeners to participate in this outreach. So I'm going to let you ask them.
Oh, I would love it. Absolutely love it. Again, one of my main goals is to figure out, is to grow the yarn industry. I want people, you know, the minute that I walked into Atelier in San Francisco for the first time and fell in love with fiber and fell in love with the things that you could do with it, it was like love at first sight. And I know that sounds silly, but it kind of was. And I want other people to feel that. And it's good for our industry. It's good for people. It's good, you know, it's great for your health. So, you know, we really brainstorm on what audiences out there can we reach. You know, there are college audiences, and, you know, we need to pick Beans for Brains back up this year, and we dropped it last year just because we were having a tough time and didn't have the staff to man it. But colleges, nurses, teachers, you know, what other groups out there, or how else can we grow the industry? You know, who else can we reach out to? So I would love suggestions, you know, and especially if you've got specific suggestions or ways that we could figure out how to do it, you know, in-house or reaching out to other people. I'm really excited, you know, and would really love to hear from you. Again, it's Laura@JimmyBeansWool, or you can hop on Benjamin's site and leave suggestions there, but we'll take them.
All right, so Fiber Hooligans, you know, you've now been deputized. You are also now responsible for helping us grow the industry and making us more visible out there in the world. And so we're going to start a thread up there on our Ravelry group, our Fiber Hooligans Ravelry group, and we're going to ask you for your ideas. If you've got a specific idea, of course, you can always email Laura as well, laura@jimmybeanswool.com. But, I want to hear what you have to say. So we're coming down to pretty close to the end of the interview, Laura, and you've been wonderful, of course. Are there any shout-outs you'd like to make before we head on out of here?
You know, there are 1,000 of them. There really are. I'm going to limit it to two, and one is to my husband, to Doug. He's a phenomenal architect and a phenomenal business advisor and a phenomenal person to work with and live with and all that kind of stuff. And the second one is Diane Susie. If you're not familiar with Knitting Pure and Simple Patterns, then Google Knitting Pure and Simple or go to her site. She, like I said, was my mentor when I opened the store. Somebody would come in and say, okay, now it says to do a 3-needle bind-off. And I would literally call her, and I still remember her phone number. I won't tell you, though. I'd call her. I'd be like, Diane, how do you do a 3-needle bind-off? And she would tell me, and then I'd tell the customer, and then I'd be like, okay, thanks. And I call her back an hour later, Diane, how do you do Kitchener stitch? she'd tell me, you know, and I'd tell the customer or we'd work on it. And she was so patient, and she is one of the smartest people I've ever met and one of the she's got more integrity than any person that I've ever met, and I've just learned so much. And if I could be even half as good of a person as she is, then I would be pretty lucky.
That's a nice, those are nice, two nice shout-outs. Okay, so final question, and I give all my guests fair warning. I gave you fair warning about this, too. But before we wrap this up, I'd like to ask if you have a final message that you'd like to share with our listeners.
Oh, you did warn me, and I didn't take the warning. I didn't drink enough coffee. Final message. You know, just remember that every single business that's out there, small business, whether it's in the yarn industry or whether it's in some other industry, is run by real people that have real lives and that are have real problems and aren't perfect. And cut them some slack. So just cut me some slack.
I think there's nothing wrong with that as a final message, honestly, just to remember that, you know, to be a human being along the way.
Yes. Yeah, that's it.
All right. Well, that's perfectly great. So I'd like to thank you again for joining us today, Laura. I know you've been very busy running back and forth with Atlanta, getting your new writing career up and running, as well as, you know, you're not sitting around on the couch watching Oprah and eating bonbons. You know, I'm hoping that, are you going to be going to TNNA in Indianapolis later this week?
Yes. Yep, I'll be there on Thursday.
So I'll see you then. And in the meantime, I want to thank you for being on this show and tell you that it was great. And please have a great day.
Thank you, Ben. And thank you so much for the opportunity. I really, really, really appreciate it. And I can't wait to see you.
You take care.
Okay. Talk to you later.
That was Laura Zander. You can check out what she's doing at jimmybeanswool.com. And eventually, when she starts writing for the New York Times, we'll post links to that as well. Regarding jimmybeanswool.com, I encourage you all to jump up there and check out this great online store. In particular, check out the great gift ideas they put together. You know, Mother's Day is coming up. And, again, the yarn bouquet is just really interesting to me. So you should take a look at that. And if you're in the Reno area, of course, you want yourself to stop in this store. Okay, you know what time it is.
And now it's time for State of the Hooligan with Tammy Burke.
I'd like to welcome back host of State of the Hooligan, moderator of our Fiber Hooligans Rivalry Group, and administrator of our Fiber Hooligans Facebook page to tell us all what's new and cool in the fiber arts world, our roving virtual reporter, my friend and fellow Fiber Hooligan, Tammy Burke. Tammy joins us again from Boise, Idaho. Good morning, Tammy, and welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Benjamin. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday.
Wasn't Laura awesome?
You know, again, just kind of an inspiring person. I mean, it takes a lot of self-confidence to be that vulnerable. I mean, she's smart and she's savvy and she's, you know, willing to make hard calls, but to kind of talk so candidly about her life and her business and self-criticize with the concept of not just beating herself up, but, you know, how you do things better. A lot of great life lessons in the way that she approaches things.
Forward to meeting her someday. She seems like a very inspirational person, human as well as thoughtful and smart, funny.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You were at Stitches West and she was there, and I guess you guys didn't get a chance to meet. I promise next time you guys are at the same show, I'll introduce you. Okay.
Oh, great! That's awesome. Thank you.
No problem. So, how was your week?
It was pretty good. I got lots of knitting done. How's your week? Getting packed to go to TNNA.
Yeah, you know, I'm driving to TNNA this time. I like driving if I can. For Fiber Hooligan listeners that know me, I hate flying. If I can drive, I will drive 2 days rather than flying a half a day. I just hate flying. I find the whole thing stressful. I mean, I'm not a fearful flyer or anything like that, but just I do get a little claustrophobic. You know, I can usually sleep my way through it, but I just don't enjoy the experience. It just feels like, you know, we're moving through being herded like cattle, and, you know, I get frustrated you know, there is no such thing. There's no such word as pre-board. And, you know, either boarding or you're not boarding, you know. And Breezeway is not something that I think it's. And, you know, you're the ultra hip, you know, customer with the super advantage plus points, whatever. And that line that you go through has got a piece of carpet and it is exactly 1 foot from the other one. I mean, how special is that? I don't know. There's just a lot of things about flying that drive me crazy. So I'm always really happy to, you know, get to the airport bar and put at least one beer in me to make it bearable. So, you know, driving 12 hours to Indianapolis sounds like a dream to me. And Elaine and I are going to drive up together and we're going to listen to an audiobook, and it's going to be awesome. So it's a nice way to start a show.
Yes, awesome. It's very ideal. I like that plan.
Yeah. Yeah, well, then the cool thing there is then we'll have a car in Indianapolis, too, so, you know, we can maybe leave the hotel. I mean, you know what it's like, too. You've done these shows. You never leave the hotel. I mean, you just never leave the hotel, you know.
Well, it's a bit more of a challenge, that's for sure.
Yeah,
but there's
yeah,
so many people you're going to be there's so many people you're going to be seeing and having that almost quiet time on the way home again will probably return you to your family with more sense of peace of mind than if you had just stepped off the plane.
Yeah, I think so too. So, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, your mindset does a lot to determine your success at these shows.
Yes.
You know, whether you're at a consumer event or a wholesale event, if you're upset or you're down or you're not doing well, if you're the guy that has to be in front of people and sell or promote or be an advocate for your company or your whatever, and, you know, the first thing you have to do is try to shake off a plane ride that's frustrated you, you know, you haven't gotten your luggage, all the kinds of things can happen. And I'm not saying that car riding is the same. You know, you can break down and still have stress, but yeah, it's, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Anyway, enough about me. I always look forward to your report, and I know you have a good one. We've already talked about it a little bit. This is going to be fun for you, so why don't you start with your subject for the week?
Well, in keeping with that, with what we've been talking about the last few minutes, my State of the Hooligan topic for this week is TNNA. Many of us have heard of TNNA from whatever source, whether it's our local yarn store owners or our favorite yarn companies letting us know that they're going to be there. And I just wanted to mention that's not what TNNA is. That's just the event. The organization, and this is information that I looked up at their website, tnna.org, to learn more about them. The National Needle Arts Association is actually a membership-based community of professional businesses that encourages the passion for needle arts through education, industry knowledge exchange, and strong marketplace. That's from their website. So they're not just focused on knitting, and they are divided into groups. One is a yarn group, but then there's also the spinners and weavers group, the needlepoint group, and then there's the counted thread and embroidery group. So it's while that it may seem like all we ever talk about is knitting or crocheting, it's TNNA is actually a lot more than that. I want to give the impression, don't want to give the impression either that this is something that I get to go to or that it's open for the general public. This is basically a meetup for the members of the organization to gather and share what they're excited about going on in the fiber industry. And up until now, it's just been a look and order thing. Attendees are not going shopping to bring stuff home. However, we who are not there get to reap the benefits because local yarn store owners are encouraged to come to the event, even if it's just the day. They get to see what yarn companies are offering in upcoming months, and they get to voice their opinions in person about what they see happening in their own stores to vendors who want to hear. And perhaps they're connecting with resources that can help them increase their own business when they get home. So they will see what publishers are showing in upcoming issues of their magazines and books. They get to meet teachers, maybe organize a visit to their stores for a meet and greet with that person, and as in classes or retreats and getting to learn new techniques from. Outside of these events, though, TNNA organizes other things that people may have heard of. For instance, there's the Helping Hands program, which mentors creativity and a feeling of achievement between adults and young people through the teaching of needle arts. TNNA Cares, which works to increase literacy through its needle and thread program. There's also Stitch to Win Against Breast Cancer and Walk to Win. And then there's the TAPS program, which is Tragedy Assistance for Program for Survivor, which works to comfort families of lost military personnel. They appear at the Makers Faire, which is the world's largest do-it-yourself festival, and sponsored by Make Magazine. These fairs take place all over the country. It's a two-day family-friendly event. The next one happening in San Mateo, California, in a couple of weeks. Spinzilla comes up in October, which happens without leaving your home. You register online, I believe, and you track what you've spun during a certain period of time, and then the grand total is added up all across the country. For instance, last year they spun enough yarn to stretch between New York and Chicago, and they hope to eventually stretch from coast to coast. And they award prizes for that stuff, so that's awesome. But my favorite event that TNNA is involved with is Stitch and Pitch, which is where Major League and Minor League baseball teams reserve sections of seats at a reduced rate, and then area vendors get to set up stalls in the hallways and introduce themselves to the public. TNNA says on their website that Stitch and Pitch is the embodiment of one of our association goals, encouraging passion and education of the needle arts among the public. Our members see it as a win-win because they shine as a positive light in their businesses, on their businesses in the local media and the community. It's a fun night out, but the contacts made and the lessons learned during the simple baseball game can have a lasting effect on the fans who often become customers, end quote. I myself have gone to Seattle Mariners Stitch and Pitch games. I got to meet Nikki Epstein at one after she'd thrown up the first pitch. They organized charity things like last year in Seattle. They asked for preemie hats that went to local hospitals, and TNNA, while they're there, gets to promote their Helping Hands efforts. Everyone has a good time. It was amazing for me to see over 3,000 knitters, a sea of stitching actually going on, all kinds of things, women, children, men, knitting, crocheting, embroidering, hand stitching, quilts. You can find information about those events at stitchandpitch.com, which I recommend, because toward the end of this month, May 30th, the minor leagues start with the Durham Bulls in North Carolina, and the major leagues, Washington Nationals, both start the Stitch and Pitch season. You can find out information about that at the website. So TNNA is really a much bigger organization and is generally known, and I hope that this fills in the blanks for a lot of people.
I'm glad you did this report, because people always assume that TNNA is a show, and it's true. We say going to TNNA, and there's two big shows a year that a lot of us go to, but it's an association that has other stuff going on, and it's beyond yarn as well. So I thank you very much for sort of broadening the definition of what TNNA is and letting our listeners know a little bit more about it. For yarn shops that aren't participating in TNNA, I've really been recommend that you get up to TNNA.org and check it out. There's good stuff there. There's you can't make it to the show, fine, but there are still resources that you will find valuable. I guarantee you that. And for, those of you local yarn stores that are in the Indianapolis area, you don't have to come for the weekend, but you should come. Especially this show is a fun show. I mean, lots of new different kinds of yarns, and, hey, if you're listening, you can even come and see me. So,
Great
report as always, Tammy. It's always good. I always forget that at the consumer level, this stuff is not as apparent to those of us who've been in the industry for a long time. So well done.
Thank you. Happy Monday.
Well done. Well, you did another great segment, and I'm going to wish you happy Monday. And of course, we won't be talking again for 2 weeks, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. But hopefully not too many pictures will be taken of me online, but I will try to keep in touch while I'm there so we can plan the next Barbara Hooligan show while I'm at the show. So have a great week, Tim.
Pictures of you and Peeps seem to show up pretty easily.
It does. That's fun for me to see
at home.
All right. Well, we'll see if we can get that done. You have a great day.
You too. Take care.
That was Tammy Burke, host of State of the Hooligan and admin of our Fiber Hooligans Facebook page and moderator of our Fiber Hooligans Ravelry group. for those of you who may have missed anything in this podcast, I invite you to join us on one of our groups. Tammy does a great job of making sure we answer questions and provide links and follow-up to anything you might have heard on the show. Next week, we won't be having a show. I'll still be in Indianapolis at TNNA. And again, if you're at TNNA, I encourage you to stop by the Hopscotch web booth, booth 326, and say hello. I always like to meet fiber hooligans. But the following week, I will be back with Stuart Hawkward and Caitlin Eaton from Prime Publishing. If you don't recognize that name, Prime Publishing, that's because you probably know them from one of their more well-known online presences like allfreeknitting.com, allfreecrochet.com, stitchandunwind.com, and the Knitpicky Patterns e-newsletters, just to name a few. These are great folks that do a wonderful job reaching millions of knitters and crocheters with killer content, and they've been great partners to our company, XRX, as well as many of our Stitches vendors and sponsors. I'm excited to have them on the show to share their story with you and to make a very special announcement about the future of Fiber Hooligan. I'm not going to talk about it a lot right now, but you really do not want to miss this show. I also want to make sure that you know that I'm eager to hear if you can email me questions, recommendations, critiques, and feedback at benjamin@fiberhooligan.com. And that includes suggestions for guests or other cool things you'd like Tammy to talk about in her segment. Of course, if you want to email Tammy directly, you can do so at tammy@fiberhooligan.com. I don't promise to respond to every email or message, but I do promise to do my best to read them all. If you ask a really great question or have an inspired idea, I may even read your email on the podcast. Well, that's our show, Fiber Hooligans. As we slide on out of here today, I'd like to wish you all a glorious week. Remember, the only thing better than being creative is being kind to each other. The good news, you can do both. Thank you for spending this time with us. We'll see you in 2 weeks for another edition of Fiber Hooligans.